Thank you for listening to this Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler. Now, before we get started, I just want to take a moment to thank Footman James for sponsoring Last Blast. As you know, at The Intercooler, we only partner with like-minded organisations, with companies that we think really understand what it means to be a car enthusiast. Footman James fit into that perfectly. I know this because when talking to them before making this recording, they said to me, please don't talk about car insurance, which I think says a lot. So instead, I'm just going to give you a couple of reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. Coffee and chrome, for one thing, that's Footman James' regular car meet. It's free to attend once you're registered, and it's where hundreds, if not a thousand, car enthusiasts get together with their classics to enjoy and share their passion for cars. Footman James also publishes its Indicator Report. It's a thorough analysis and a detailed report into the state of classic car ownership in this country. The point is to promote and safeguard the future of classic cars in the UK. So there you go, two good reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. So thank you, Footman James. Go and visit footmanjames.co.uk. You're listening to the Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler. On Last Blast this week is the CEO of Bentley Motors, Adrian Hallmark, with Andrew Frankel.
Hello everybody and welcome to another Last Blast podcast. Sitting next to me today at the Goodwood Festival of Speed is Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Bentley Motors, Mr. Adrian Hallmark. If you happen to hear the sounds of motorcycles, racing cars and that sort of thing coming past, and Red Arrows as well, who I think are going ahead now. That's why we're at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, so hopefully the noise will all add to the atmosphere. Adrian, thank you so much for joining us.
Great pleasure, Andrew.
Good to see you. And as I think you know, everybody who comes on here has a few things to do, a few things to tell me. The first of which is, what was your first car?
My first car, which I loved, was a yellow, Daytona yellow, actually, a Ford colour, Mini Clubman. 1000cc, I couldn't insure a 1275.
What year?
It was 1970.
It was a 1970 car,
yeah.
But presumably this wasn't in 1970, so it was quite old.
Sorry, 1979.
1970, so it was a 9-year-old Mini Clubman.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. Wonderful, I think that's a very good first car. Mm-hmm. Lots of people of our sort of era had Minis, didn't they?
They did.
And lots of them crashed them, so I now have to ask you what your first crash was.
I'm one of those people.
You crashed your Clubman.
I had Cosmic wheels and Dunlop SP70s when I first built it, and it was wonderful. The handling, the grip was incredible. I was also racing motorcycles, I'll come to that later. Wore the tyres down in about a month, couldn't afford a new set of SP70s, so bought some remolds for about £20.
Yeah.
Second time out in it, in the rain, lost control, threw a bridge wall, rolled it, wrote it off.
But not yourself?
No, I was without seatbelt, uninjured.
Wow. And you flipped it?
17 years of age, rolled. Yeah. I had it 2 weeks. Six weeks. 4 weeks with the original tyres, 2 weeks before I finished it.
And that was the end of the Clubman?
Exactly.
Right, okay. And the third question I have to ask you before we get onto your list of cars is, what was the first time you ever drove or rode anything on a track?
Rode, I was 15. So I used to race motocross. And I raced between 15 and 21 years of age.
Wow.
And the first time I went on a track was actually 19, because a company I worked for, two very successful entrepreneurs, bought the remnants of March in Cambridge in the late 70s.
Right.
And we took older Formula 3 chassis, put Volvo rally engines into them,
right.
1500 dryliner developed by Porsche, and entered the Monoposto Championship. They did. And I helped build the cars, studying engineering.
Yeah.
It was kind of a practice to the theory. And I also used to go and test the cars with them now and again. So I was 90 when I first jumped in a single seater.
Wow, that's not a bad first car to drive on a track. Fair play. So where did it all start for you? Was it all, were you always going to be involved in mechanics and engineering? I detect that although we all know you for your time in the automotive world, that motorcycles, would they be your true passion? Or
I've kind of grown out of them.
Yeah?
When you don't care about what happens,
yeah,
they are the best thing in the world. And I wouldn't have changed that period in my life, because it definitely was formative. You know, from a discipline, fitness, mindset, organisation, technical skills, and then competitiveness. Yeah. You know, reasonably high level, national level, very intense, and I loved it. But you know, I've ridden them since. I've still got a collection of trials bikes.
Right.
They're safer. I describe the difference of falling off a motocrosser on a trials bike. Falling off a crosser is like jumping out of a car at 50 miles an hour. You might survive, but it's going to hurt. Falling off a trials bike is like falling off a garage roof backwards onto soft ground. You'd be really unlucky if you hurt yourself.
Right.
But it's just very uncomfortable.
So have you fallen off a trials bike recently?
Oh, not in the last 5 years, actually. This last time I just broke my finger.
Okay.
Nothing major, but all my life I've been a regular customer of A&E departments. and I have no interest in bikes on the road. I love the technology, but no, off-road is the only thing I'm interested in.
So let's start at the beginning. You went to study engineering at university.
Yep.
So were you set on being involved in the car world and making your career that way? Is that something that you always wanted to do for as long as you can remember?
I think yes. But there was this twist, because as I went through school, and I grew up around in the Midlands, so around me there was all the manufacturers you could think of. And by the time I'd graduated, which I actually went into a heavy industrial company, it was NEI Thompson, so-called, that day. They were bought by Rolls-Royce Engineering later. I went that route, sponsored through my studies, etc., worked and studied. 18 months as a design engineer, wanted to get into the auto industry, but at that time, early 80s, it had pretty much disappeared. Yeah. Always in real trouble, couldn't get a role in the manufacturer, so I actually went into retail and left engineering. I thought I can always go back, but maybe that way I can get into a manufacturer and off we go. And that's exactly what happened. 5 years later, I was running quite a big individual business. Applied for a job at Porsche as regional manager at 27 years of age. Got it. Took about a 40% pay cut to do it because I knew it's the direction I wanted to go. And within 5 years, I was the CEO in the UK. So it was, I sometimes look back and think, how the hell did anybody give me these chances? But, you know, I did work hard. I think did think deep. I did get stuff done. And it was also a really formative time in my career. It was in crisis, especially in the early 90s. The then CEO, who I took over from, was Kevin Gaskell.
Yes.
And between us, we completely reshaped the company and the brand. And it was, you know, for a young guy, it was dream job, absolutely brilliant.
So let's just pause there for a moment, because the other thing we have to do during the course of this is get through your list of six cars, one of which at the end of this you're going to have to tell us is the one you take for your last blast. And notably, all your cars are competition cars.
Yeah.
Which I think probably says it's quite revealing of the sort of person you are and the sort of things that you like.
Yeah.
So tell us about the first of them.
Just why they're competition cars. This sounds awful, but you'd probably say the same thing. I've driven most of the road cars ever built.
Yes.
There's not many I haven't driven.
Yeah.
A Koenigsegg and a few others, but for me, I admire achievement, excellence, and both technology-wise, but also from a human perspective. So I love the stories of the people and those cars. So Bugatti. Obviously, Bugatti and Bentley were strong competitors in the 20s.
Yes.
And I love Bugattis ever since I couldn't remember. Because I remember having a Type 35 model car. Yeah. It was a generic sports car, but then I found out more about it. And it was only then when later, I was very lucky to get to do the Mille Miglia in a Bentley Blower.
Yeah.
And because you go in age order, of course. We sat behind the four 35C Bugattis that were in that particular year, with an Alfa 8C in between us. And I just fell in love with it even more. And the difference, the thing I love about that period, there was no right and wrong. They hadn't worked out aero, they didn't understand track width, wheelbase, engine placement in the car, stroke, bore. Everybody had a different philosophy, it was trial and error. Yeah. And when you put a Type 35 next to a blower, it almost looks ridiculous. It's like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito. And I just love the elegance, the fact that every part is art, is the mindset.
Absolutely.
And it's true when you look at that car. So from a technical point of view, I love cycling, and I love cycles because of the exquisite lightweight, minimalist, but super strong technology.
Yeah.
And I look at the Bugatti Type 35 and thought, that's it. It's the leanest and most beautiful thing that goes fast that I can imagine. And I'm not the leanest, most beautiful thing that goes fast, but that car is what I'd love to be.
Brilliant. So you find yourself in charge of Porsche in the UK in the mid-1990s, when Porsche as a company was not in a good state. What was that like? It was actually, you were there for during the huge upheaval, weren't you?
So it was fantastic. I mean, I'd recommend anybody earlier in their career to get into a company that's in crisis. You know, a crisis brings out the best and worst in everybody, and it simplifies everything. So, you know, globally, we were selling about 60,000 a year, 60,000 Porsches a year then. New 964 had been launched, big step forward in technology, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly the crash happened. Black Monday or Friday, I can't, never remember which one, but 91. Porsche went from 63,000 production down to 13. We had an order bank of over 3,000 cars in the UK. I was a regional manager, went around the dealers, checked the validity of all of these orders, and they were putting them in so they could get an allocation. We got it down to about 60 orders. And we ended up, the market collapsed. We lost about two-thirds of the volume in the UK at the same time. We ended up with about 3,000 cars in stock and a sales rate of 800 per year. I'll say that again. No, I won't. It took us 2 years to get through it. We just built no new cars. And it was phenomenal in terms of restructuring, motivating dealers, the club sport. We created that from nothing. We had to try and get the 968 to work, because it didn't. It was very expensive for what it was.
So was the 968 club sport, did the motivation for that come from the UK?
Yeah, it was myself and Kevin in a argument, we call it a meeting. Yeah. We used to call it the argument, organised argument. In a meeting, why can't you sell more? Because they're not competitive. Here's an idea. Get it back to its roots. The product's got fat and flabby.
Yeah.
And whilst it's okay to have a more comfortable Porsche, you need to give 968 a heart and soul, that people look at it and admire it like a 911. And it won't ever be a 911, but it's got to be better than the current 968.
Yeah.
Take everything out, make as much noise as you can, and make it a track monster. And the guy that ran four-cylinder development, Thomas, I can't remember his surname now, he was given time with us to define it, respect it. We defined the product characteristics. He developed it 6 months later, launched it. And, you know, it didn't sell high volumes, but it transformed the image. And at the same time, we got the new 911 coming in, 993, and we just took off. I love crises. I don't like causing them. But the opportunity to cut through politics, get it down to simple targets, simple decisions, make lots of them, and get people motivated, that's from racing motorbikes. I love when I'm fueled with adrenaline. I don't want to impose it too much on others, but in a crisis, I have no option.
So, and then you go from there, so you go from being in charge of Porsche in the UK to taking the marketing director role at Bentley.
Yeah.
In 99?
Yes.
Tell us about that. What made you go from sort of, you know, head of one from an importer to the board seat of a British manufacturer?
It comes back to my first comment about where I wanted to go.
Yeah.
So I left retail to go to Porsche, but I didn't want to be in a distribution company. I wanted to be in an OEM. So this was a chance to be in a car company that designs them, develops them, builds them, ships them, brands them, sells them, the whole thing. And I'd also confidentially done a study on Rolls-Royce and Bentley for someone when I was at Porsche under NDA, so I won't say who.
No, but this was when Rolls-Royce and Bentley were still Vickers owned.
Yes, before they actually were officially for sale.
Yeah.
and concluded Bentley had massive potential. So much of the strategy that I defined before I came is what we ultimately delivered. So how about that? You get the chance to do an interview or do a strategy for a company you don't work for and that's not for sale, and then get the chance to go and implement it about 3 years later. How could I say no? And it was a bit bizarre. I'll never forget Steve Cropley. So Porsche, we turned it around. I was the golden boy back in Stuttgart. And it was all going great. 36 years of age, and got to be sales and marketing director, board member. It was the longest title you've ever seen. Board member, sales, marketing, and PR, Bentley Motors Limited. Had a very long card.
But they're now Volkswagen-owned Bentley Motors Limited.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Got there, and Cropley said, but they were selling like 800 cars a year, been through all that turmoil. He said, have you done that, mate? Hell, have you done that, mate? And I said, well, this could be huge. And I can't, at Porsche, I can keep on making incremental change. At Bentley, I could actually help to transform this brand.
And you could see what was coming up.
And I'm right at the origin of the strategy, the technology, and the rebirth of a brand that's got huge potential. What would you do?
So just before we go on to talk more about your first stint at Bentley, your second car is sort of kind of, you know, finishing off the Porsche era. You have another Porsche.
Yeah, well, two. It's funny how things are connected. So back in the Porsche days, had a lovely time, met some wonderful people, Derek Bell, Richard Atwood, all the greats of the day. Now, Richard Atwood was born about 5 miles away from where I was born.
Of course, he's a Wolverhampton boy, isn't he?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the fact he was the first ever outright winner for Porsche at Le Mans with Hans Herrmann,
yeah.
I was just in awe of him. Always had been since I loved Bugatti.
And still are.
Absolutely.
Yeah, me too.
Big hug last night. I haven't seen him for about 8 years. He hasn't changed a bit. Anyway, so lovely person and iconic in terms of what he did for Porsche.
Yeah.
And that 917, yes. Knowing Piëch and his mindset and what that car was, how it performed, its top speed, the risk they took in lightweighting, the materials they used for the tubular chassis. It was an engineering tour de force. Piëch's one of his masterpieces. Yeah. And Dickie drove it. Derek Bell obviously also drove them. And if you listen to either of them talk about the speed of the car, the lack of structure, and the fact that their feet were in front of the axle of the front wheels,
yes.
And they're still driving at 236 miles an hour.
And paper-thin bodywork, and that was it. Then it was your feet. Then it was the back of the pedals, and then it was your feet.
It's just incredible what they did.
Yeah.
Technically, it was ferocious. To jump in that as a human being and race and win at those speeds, I've just got total respect for those people. So that car for me is iconic.
Okay, we do have another Porsche Le Mans car coming up, but before that, and while we're still on the subject of Le Mans, you were instrumental in taking Bentley back to Le Mans in 2001 with that program. So just to tell us a little bit about that idea, how that came about, and what that time was like at Bentley. It must have been amazing.
It was super. We had massive support from Piëch personally, who was a great advocate for the brand, and we'd pitched the...
Despite the fact that Audi were already racing there.
Yeah, but we basically defined the strategy, redefined it compared with what he had originally bought it to do with, and he went with us. So it was, the price of the cars were 50% higher than was proposed. Instead of one body we wanted three, instead of one engine we wanted two, but apart from that it was what he originally wanted. Not at all. But we also knew that Rolls-Royce, when it went to BMW, if they didn't do the biggest, most expensive and best sedan in the world, it wouldn't be seen as a genuine Rolls-Royce.
Yes.
And if I looked at Bentley's history, we were never orientated around stately sedans.
Yes.
So the best thing we could do to differentiate and to cut through was to do the two-door car first. The elevator pitch, a 200 miles an hour, four-wheel drive, aluminium bodied, 2+2 seater that could cross continents in ease, comfort, and also be the car that the hotel wants to put in front when you get there after they clean the bugs off. An everyday exotic brand with the reliability and credibility and daily credentials of an A8 or an S-Class in terms of durability. That was the mission. And what better way to reorientate people's thinking about Bentley to its sporting heritage than actually go back and create some more heritage. So Le Mans was the only place we could go. That was in the 11 years at the beginning of the company, from 1919 to 1930, Le Mans was the bedrock of the brand image. So we figured, okay, let's use that to position the brand and GT, and it worked. And you know, we finished third in the first year, thanks to the rain. But to finish first, you've got a first finish.
Yes.
And in year three, it was just tremendous. First and second. And it was one of the proudest moments of my career, and for many of us at Bentley. It was wonderful. And it certainly helped in the launch and positioning of the brand.
And I guess we should probably do the third car, seeing as we are still at Le Mans, which is another Porsche. The 1982 Le Mans winner, the 956. What is it about that car? What does it mean to you?
I love Derek Bell.
Yeah.
And the car was a breakthrough. So it was the first monocoque racer in that category. I mean, 246 miles an hour,
yes,
top speed.
Yes.
And Ickx set the lap record at over 146. I mean, it was like from another planet when it came. We thought 917 was good. But this was just another step, and it was really the beginning of the consistent success of Porsche in that period. And I think both Ickx and Bell were, again, and Stuckey later, amongst the most iconic drivers for the brand as well. So for me, it was just having been in that company for 10 years and seeing all the great cars, from the Berlin-Rome car right the way through to what was it, the GT1s when I left.
Yeah.
That was the last race car before I moved to Bentley. I think that even more so than the 962, that for me was the breakthrough car. 962 was fantastic as well.
But it was a development.
But this was the genesis, the next was an incremental change.
But it's interesting to me that your car choices seem to be very linked to people.
Yes. At the beginning, as I say, it's all about the people that develop it, Zynga,
yeah.
The people that drive it, and the technology itself, and what they then achieve. Because nothing is guaranteed when you put a pair of overalls on and jump in a race car.
Yeah.
The variables are ridiculous. And you know, to be able to get something to go as fast as faster than anything possible,
yeah,
and keep it at that limit for as long as possible and not break, and the person not to wear, you know, become weary or wear down. It's just, I think competition is the essence of any brand in some way, shape, or form. And that's why I love these cars. It's the pinnacle of human achievement at that time, in my view.
So there you were at Bentley, but in 2005 you left.
Yes.
And you went elsewhere. So having sort of got your dream job, you gave it up.
Yeah, but you got to remember, and I look back now and I think maybe I was too hot-headed, but I'm 42, okay? and not now, then,
no, then
I was 42.
Yes.
Now I'm 44, even though we're just talking about 2005. So I was 42 years of age. I was full of beans.
Yeah.
And we'd done what we'd done, and I loved Dr. Pefkin as well, the CEO.
Yeah.
Our relationship was incredible.
So Le Mans had been won, the GT had been incredibly successfully launched.
We'd taken the company from 800 to 10,000 sales,
yeah,
in 7 years,
yeah,
or six and a bit years. And every bit of the strategy that we wrote, we delivered.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Yeah.
And we segment the marketplace. So if you look at cars sold between £100,000 and £150,000 then,
yeah,
there were only 3,000 worldwide per year. It was a few Astons, a few Ferraris, a few Rolls Royces and a few Bentleys. We wanted to sell 10,000 in that 3,000 segment. And we did. We created a segment. And when we sold 10, the segment was 14. So we had over two-thirds share. We made it. So you think, I wasn't arrogant, but I thought, great, I can't do this for another 20 years.
Yeah.
I need to do something else.
Yeah.
And the group were great. They wanted to develop me. So I went to be CEO of Volkswagen in America, which was, you know, 500,000 car business, 500,000 car sales business, yes, compared with 10,000. Yeah. Okay, we didn't build cars, but the plan was that we would. And I did the strategy for the factory and the breakthrough products there. Of course, the 08, 09, yeah, 10 recession hit and put a little bit of a kibosh on some of the plans, but still, the factory was built, and slowly but surely, the strategy has been realized, but in a longer period. But it was, again, working in America. I'll give you one example. There's one Toyota dealer group, and it's a group that's just based in LA. And between their four sites, they sell 70,000 Toyotas a year. This is a dealer, which is more than BMW sold in the UK, of all BMWs.
One dealer.
As the importer. So they're as big as BMW UK, one dealer. We had a VW dealer that did 15,000 cars a year. So when you go to that market, you see the scale of demand, the professionalism. It's like a factory. That Toyota workshop, yeah, after sales, it's like a car factory. It's incredible. So I really enjoyed it.
And it wasn't somehow more impersonal just because of the scale and the number of people and the fact that you just couldn't get to know as many people the same way that you did in a tiny little OEM back in the Northwest?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit bigger, but you just have to travel more and you meet lots of people. And there's some wonderful, wherever you go, whatever brand, there's fantastic business partners, real characters. Again, like the car creators and the drivers, driven people, yeah, who create something from nothing and very successful organizations. I mean, you know Roger Penske.
Yes.
And he's not the only one. I mean, there's lots of people like him in the US that are just inspirational as business people. And they do it. I think that the US dealers are the best in the world.
And you went to Asia as well?
Yeah, so then I went to run Volkswagen Asia, which was 1.2 million car sales a year, that region, including China. I was based in Wolfsburg and Asia. Did that for just 2 years, and it almost killed me, actually. I'd fly out, I'd spend a week in Wolfsburg and 3 weeks in Asia, and then come back. And whilst in Asia, each month, I'd do a lap. So by 3 months, I'd done every country, 57 markets. And it was good. Built small factories, these sub-assembly factories, grew various markets. It was really complicated. The biggest portfolio job I've got in terms of remit, but it was so far from being entrepreneurial. It was more political and administrative. Wasn't even really strategic. Didn't enjoy it. It's the one job where I feel I learned a huge amount. I don't regret doing it, but I wouldn't have wanted to stay doing that for long.
No.
Maybe staying in China, running one big region, yes, but doing what I was doing, it was crazy. Constant jet lag.
And you then, I think, left the group?
Yes. So I had a couple of options, and I thought, I'm going to roll the dice. Because I've got what I've got. You know, I've won it. I've got my CV, I've got my track record, I've got bags load of energy. And I had the opportunity to go to join Spyker in the takeover of Saab.
Wow.
With equity options. And in my youth, back to these entrepreneurs and the racing, they had Saab and Volvo dealers. And I also loved Saab 900 turbos. Although I never owned one because they were too fast and expensive for me to insure. I loved the brand. I knew what they paid for it. I fundamentally believed it could work. So off I went to Trollhättan. And we restarted the factory, refinanced the company, got it working again, launched the 9.3, the new 9.5, and even the 9.4. Do you remember those, the SUV? It was based on a GM platform that was built in Mexico. We Saabified it and built it in Trollhättan. And it was beautiful. We didn't sell many because of various factors that then ensued, but it was a really, really good car. V6, anyway, wonderful thing. 6-7 months in, you could feel things were going wrong.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say I was naive, but there were certain things that happened that just knocked it in a certain direction that I won't talk about. And I got a call from Jaguar Land Rover to be the managing director of Jaguar, which again would be back in an OEM with a global responsibility, yeah, for a British brand. And when I was young, there were only two brands I really, really wanted to run. Bentley wasn't one of them. I didn't even think about it then. One was Porsche, global, and the other was Jaguar. And Jaguar, because it had never performed the way it did when he had Hittite.
Yes.
And it was just under, like I felt about Bentley when I finally did the study, totally undervalued an underdeveloped brand that has great potential. So there I went and spent 7 years with Jaguar Land Rover before then
heading back
here as the CEO.
And was Jaguar Land Rover, we're not going to dwell on it, but was that a positive experience for you? Did you find it quite sort of political and difficult to make the changes that you wanted?
It's funny because yes and no. I think the way the Tata managed that business is world class. There is no interference. To the point at times where I figured, you know, having worked in a subsidiary of the Volkswagen Group and knowing the controls and the reporting and the constant scrutiny, it's not oppressive, but it's just a routine. You have to do it. Tata, it's almost fatalistic. Rattan's vision is you pick the right people, the right business in the sector, and you make sure they have a strong strategy and encourage them to deliver it.
And then let it get on with it.
And don't get in the way. Yeah. He's the most humble gentleman I've ever met, and a multi-billionaire, which is almost a paradoxical statement. So from that point of view, never worked in a better, more entrepreneurial culture. Within the business itself, people's spirit to get things done, unbelievable. And I've seen nothing better in any international company in terms of capability or drive than I've seen in Jaguar Land Rover. It's full potential. Yes, overall, certainly don't regret going. Love the experience, gained a lot. Did 3 and a bit years just running Jaguar, and then the last 3.5 years in a strategy role for the two brands, which was the most complicated and developmental role I've ever done. Products, factories, digital, mobility investments, corporate strategy, and all the business planning and target setting for all the functions. And it was almost perfect training to be the CEO. I used to describe it as it's almost all the responsibility of the CEO without the elevated heart rate and bonus risk. And coming to Bentley, it was incredible because everything I've had to do, I've just done for 3.5 years on speed.
Yeah.
So it's funny how things go and how you only realize what you've got when you move on and apply it somewhere else. And so coming here has been almost everything I ever learned in study, everything I've ever done in crisis or in growth and brand reshaping in the past, I'm doing it again to the power three here, and it feels easy because despite semiconductors and COVID, it's fairly logical what you need to do. Yeah. It's trying to get it done that's the complicated part. With all the other competing factors.
Okay, so before we get back to Bentley, we're going to have another car. We're going rallying.
We are.
Go on.
Again, I'll give you the anecdote of the story. So, Walter Roll, Audi short wheelbase Quattro, Group B rally car. Legend has it that after Piëch did the 917 and didn't get the top job at Porsche, he went to Audi as R&D chief.
Yeah.
And they developed the Audi 80. And at Ingolstadt, they organised a big event with a grandstand, a bit like this, for thousands of press to come and see the new Audi 80 getting launched. While they were building the grandstand and getting it all ready, people noticed in the distance a mound being built of dirt. I thought they may be just doing some excavation or whatever. Anyway, so they got to the event, the Audi 80 was there, and at a certain point in the proceedings, the short wheelbase Audi Quattro rally car, coupe, came out of a tent, did a few swirls, a bit like this the drifters do here, and leapt off this dirt bank, landed, skidded off, and parked in front of the crowd. And he'd done it as a skunk project. So the courage to work in an organization, do something that is that ferocious again as a technical tool, and then to go on and redefine rallying, and set a whole new generation of technology and things. I think that's another seminal car in terms of steps in technology, and another product of a genius mind. And then what Valtarol and the foot video. I mean, if you add all those three things together, it's just a wonderful, wonderful story. That's why I love it.
So you come back to Bentley. We're not that far ago. We're now 2018, I think. And what was the plan for the company? And we're going to have to mention the C word. To what extent did COVID affect what you were trying to do?
It's interesting because I think all the time. So I don't work at Jaguar Land Rover now, but I constantly think about what I would do if I was there. And when I wasn't here, I constantly looked at what was happening and thought, what would I do if I was there?
So did they come after you, or did you get to the end of the line and think, I'd need something else? And
I made it known that I was on the move. Yeah. And within 2 weeks, I was here. Not physically, but
yes.
Subject to competitive clause, etc. So I figured, looking from the outside, the company got into a bit of a Gordian knot with not launching cars, partly because of emission standards not being prepared for. Not that the cars were not possible to be legal, but they just hadn't run through the processes. And partly because the cars physically weren't getting built properly. Plus, you know, when I left, it was 10,000 cars a year without an SUV. Yeah. Now it's 10,000 cars a year with an SUV, with a market that was 14,000 when we sold 10,000. Yeah. It's now 100,000 and we're still selling 10,000.
Yeah.
So, you need to grow. You're not getting the entitlement from the brand in the marketplace. The cars are too cheap, the volume's too low. So we've got to, first thing, fix the operations and get the processes running properly, get the cars launched and get the growth that we're entitled to, get the next facelift generation done to better standards than we did the first launches, because we can't have the same problem again. Start the electrification process and get fully electric between 2030 and 25. So I had a 5-point pitch as part of the interview process. That's what I would do. I don't know what you're thinking. I don't want to be arrogant, but knowing what I know about legislation, what I've just been through for 3.5 years trying to plan for another company, and looking at where you are, those are the 5 things that I'd suggest. And that's what we're doing. So pretty much, don't get me wrong, it's not, I didn't then come in and just tell everybody this is what we're doing. We've gone through the same kind of strategy, thought process and prioritization to get as much thought and knowledge together as we can so that we get to a common view of what's needed, but it still fits into those categories. And the whole board fully aligned, the management team fully aligned, and it's absolutely liberating feeling. It's a real opportunity to transform again, probably even bigger than that first step. Not in volume terms, but the brand will stand for completely different things in 10 years' time. And that's both scary and exciting.
So just talk to me a bit about how big a hit to the business COVID and semiconductors have been.
It's interesting because before COVID, we had this B word. And we'd prepared for 2 years for a hard Brexit. We hoped it didn't happen, and eventually there was a trade deal done of sorts. Costs us a bit more money, makes things more complex, but essentially it's fine, we can cope. But in preparing for that, we had realised we can no longer run with lean stocks. We have to build buffers. We need to be more resilient. So we put in place a whole risk reduction process. Just when we got to the end of the Brexit process, and we got to January 2020, we thought, we're good.
Yeah,
we better start running the stocks down. Then COVID came, so we thought, start again. We practiced how to manage risk. So we kept the stocks high, we actually built the stocks even higher. We shut the factory for 7 weeks, cost us a fortune, and we changed everything. We put in protection for all the team, one-way systems, 2 meter distancing, changed the production line, sent everybody home, got them working digitally. We got track and trace, testing, PPE equipment, everything. When we couldn't as a country, we got it. And we got people back, and they felt safer than at home or anywhere. It was unbelievable, and the way they cared for each other. We even had a risk app, and we've got 48 digital apprentices. They created all these apps. Anybody saw anything or felt uncomfortable, they'd log it, we'd fix it within 2 hours. And we got through it. It's actually made us stronger. And then when things opened up, the order intake just rocketed. So we're already good. We were set for a record year in 2020. We were going to smash it. And then we just got this flood of order intake. And I think it was this post-crisis, right, what's going to happen next? Don't know. Life's too short. I've got it. Go enjoy yourself. And it happened with homes, with a lot of high-value goods in the luxury industry, in the luxury car business. It's just gone crazy.
But were you able to satisfy that demand with the shortage of semiconductors and chips? And
it's actually, we've been very, very lucky because we're protected, because the group protect us. We get all full allocation of everything we need. The problem is we've got capacity limitations. We can't build more than 15,000 Bentleys. So actually, all the upside that COVID gave us goes into an order bank. Because we'd already planned to sell about 14,000, and we sold about 14.5 last year. There's not much more headroom. So all that can happen is that there's a delay before we can get one. So China's the longest. US is the second longest.
Can you expand capacity? Do you want Bentley to be making more than 15,000? Do you want to be making 25,000 cars a year?
With the current product range, I think the limits are pretty close to where we are. I think we'd probably go higher than 15,000, but we need, the constraint is paint shop. It's running four shifts, 24/7 already. And if it breaks, we're dead.
And you will continue to build Bentleys just in Crewe, you won't build them, because there were a few years ago Flying Spurs made in Dresden, but that's not going to happen. You're not going to outsource it.
That was tactical.
Yeah.
And it was for a short period. No, the plan is that we get a new paint shop. That's already now confirmed. So in our 2.5 billion plan for Beyond 100, about 2 billion is product and 500 million is infrastructure. And a big part of the 500 million is the new paint shop. And that will give us more capacity. But what we'll basically do is build it so we, on two shifts, we could do 15,000 to 20,000. So it's not stressed. So we don't plan to do 25,000, but I don't want a paint shop that only does exactly what we currently sell.
But you could see a time when Bentley was making 20,000 cars a year.
Not with the current product range. You would need to do something in a different price segment. So that's not the reason we build a bigger paint shop, but in case we do want to go ever to a lower price point, then we've got the capacity, we've got no constraint in that sense.
Okay. Let's do another car. It's car 5. This is the only Bentley on your list.
Yep. Why is that the case? Because I've driven them all.
So, apart from this one, apparently.
Yeah. Yes. So, this one, the EXP Speed 8, yes. The 2003 winning Le Mans car for Bentley. Why? Because I feel it's a part of me, even though I'd never built it. But between myself and Brian Gush, I got the money and the agreements together and put the whole program in place from a strategic and commercial and brand point of view, and Brian ran the team, and it was a wonderful, wonderful project. Really, really enjoyed it, but I've never driven the car. I've not even been in the two-seater, and I don't know why.
You'll be putting that right at some stage, I'm guessing.
I will, but but everyone that drives it says, so there's a particular customer of ours who's bought five of the X race cars that we built, and he races them. And he was only 7 seconds a lap slower than Tom Christensen time in the last race at Le Mans. 7 seconds a lap, and he's my age. And he says it's the easiest car he's ever driven. It's so well behaved, precise, no vices. I want to drive the car. So watch this space.
Okay. And while we're on the subject of older Bentleys, just talk me through the continuation car strategy. You held the Festival of Speed this weekend, announced a new series of 12 Speed 6s based on the old number one Speed 6 that won Le Mans in 1929 and 1930. Some people aren't that keen on these sorts of cars, are they? Some people think that you're messing with your heritage and what was in the past should stay in the past. What do you say to them? What's the strategy behind it? And yeah, just talk to us a bit about the continuation series.
I'm looking at it as you're describing it. First of all, everyone's entitled to an opinion. And if that's the worst thing I've done in my life, I'll go to heaven rather than hell. And it's not that bad. So it's a question of judgment. So from my perspective, what have we done? We've taken the two most iconic racing Bentleys in the WO period, 19 to 30, and we've recreated them from scratch. And we've done it not to create visual replicas of the original cars, but to create, with modern techniques, facsimiles of that particular car, the blower for example, with the same materials, the same technology, but different tolerances, better oil flow, better thermal management, full engine test bed program, 15,000 miles of endurance testing, and we've made them durable, robust, and for the purposes of having a bit of fun on a track and racing, rather than risking the value of our precious, most valuable Bentley in the world, the Birkin blower car, I'd rather use that than the blower car to show people what it must have been like to drive at an average of 86 miles an hour round Le Mans in 1930 on 75% gravel, not with a 30 to 40 million pound original. And four of the people that bought the blower have original blowers. And they bought them for exactly that reason. And the rest don't, but that's fine. But the purpose of these cars is very simple. There are very few of them. They're extremely valuable. And this gives us the chance to give people a genuine, full-on vintage experience and not risk the crown jewels. So it's two race cars that have a story with each other. The full throttle story, Rowan Atkinson, get the DVD if you haven't seen it, wonderful film. The blower enabled partly the Speed 60s to be dominant by stressing the competition and getting them to break. Three wheels on my wagon moment outside the White House, legendary. Yeah. And again, it's all about the person, the car, the story, and giving people a feel of what it must have been like to drive a pristine blower Speed 6 that you can thrash and you don't have to feel guilty about. That's why we've done it, and the customers love it. And if you say four of the blowers have gone to people with original blowers, and five of the Speed 6s are being bought by people that bought the first blowers, so they're having both.
It's almost half of them will have both.
Yeah, and we're going to do events with them, so we'll take the blowers or the Speed 6s or both and do things with them that money can't buy every year. So it'll be another private club. So that's why we're doing it. A bit of fun.
Fair enough. We're going to do your last car now. I'm guessing there's another human connection here. This is Michael Schumacher's 2004 championship winning F2004 Ferrari, his seventh title winning car.
Bless him.
Yeah. Talk to me about. I wasn't necessarily expecting a Ferrari on your list.
Yeah.
So what was that?
The guy was a genius, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
And he's for me a little bit like Oasis was. I got bored with music until they came out in the mid 90s. And I kind of got a little bored with Formula One until Schumacher came out. What he achieved was phenomenal, and I think the 2004 car was the pinnacle of him and that generation of Ferraris. And he was like Hamilton 2 years ago, wasn't he? Absolutely at the zenith of his performance and career, and inspirational in every way. So whilst I'm not a big Ferrari advocate or fan, I mean, the wonderful brand, respect the company massively. They're not my kind of, from a road car point of view, I don't aspire to them particularly. I prefer other brands, not just ones in the group, of course. But in terms of Formula One, they are Formula One. And Schumacher's Ferrari. And him and that car and that period, I think it was, I just loved it. It got me interested in Formula One again.
Okay. So we're just going to have a little look into the future now, as much of it as you will tell us, which I suspect isn't much. But I was talking to your engineering director last night, and he quite encouragingly was saying to me that one of the most important things for Bentley to do when embracing the new EV era was to maintain an emotional connection, because it's about so much more than going fast and building quiet and comfortable cars. I was wondering how you do that when there are no gears to change, there is no engine to listen to, all those things that those of us who love driving and have loved driving Bentleys have cherished about those cars, and they are gone. How do you put it back?
I think I can do this logically, and I can try and do it irrationally too. So I'll do the logical one first. So if you take any one of the cars that we build today, if you take Bentayga as an example of what we build today, and imagine that as an SUV, as an electric SUV. In fact, the customers that were here just before we sat down, we're talking about, they've just sold another SUV in our price bracket to come back to Bentayga, having tried it. Had it for a year, but it's not the same as a Bentayga, is the quote. So what's a Bentayga? When you're in the car, it's like the sharpest tailored suit you ever had. The materials, the way they're used, the way they're put together, the precision, the consistency of the lines, most people can't describe why they think it looks good. There's something about perfect execution, which is what we strive for. If you look at fantastic architecture, historic, the pyramids, the Parthenon, it's these perfect aesthetics, perfectly executed, which inspire people. And they can't maybe describe the gaps, the dimensions, the form or whatever, but they know when it looks right. We are obsessive about our interiors, about the comfort, about the ergonomics, about the execution, the quality of materials, and how we do it. So an electric Bentayga, I absolutely guarantee, if you think of the previous generation Bentleys, the ones before the current ones we have, and how we've stepped up craftsmanship and technology, in the electric Bentayga, the technology, forget the battery, but the rest of the car technology will step up one or two levels compared with today. The craftsmanship and the way we do it will step up one or two levels compared with today. The comfort, the refinement, including noise isolation, as well as, let's call it well-being, treating the human in the car, technically, to make it a better experience. All of this can go to a different level, the likes of which you've never seen, and then connectivity, and then partial autonomy. So you're going to have capabilities and experiences that will make what we currently do feel quite primitive. And that's all within 5 to 10 years. And then we come to the powertrain. So I'll use a simple statistic about, well, certainly less than 10% of our customers choose sports exhaust. So let's say 70 to 80% certainly don't buy it for the noise. Yeah. I'm not saying they don't like a little bit of noise, but they don't buy it for the same reason as some of our competitors.
Yeah.
I bet that's not the case at Ferrari or Lamborghini,
for example.
I bet it's
not, yes.
So we're not a noise brand.
Yeah.
We are an everyday usable car for most of our, it's incredible. The people spend £200,000-£250,000 and that's their daily runaround, because you can.
Yeah.
And it's comfortable and you can park it and it's got four-wheel steer and it works. So we don't build loud, shouty cars.
Yeah.
We build very fast ones. They do too, they all, except for the, I mean, when the new 911 was launched, it was credited, and it does 190 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Well, so does the Bentayga, and that's an SUV. And our luxury sedan does 207,
yeah,
if we're going to compete about it.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't buy Bentleys to do 207 miles an hour, although they do. So I think our brand, if we can get all of those experiences up one or two notches, then from a powertrain point of view, we'll be 50 to 100% more power than our cars today.
Wow.
In the next 5 to 10 years. If you look at battery power density and how many equivalent horsepower you can get out of a battery pack, they're going to be huge steps.
Do you see big breakthroughs coming?
Bigger than we would have said 5 years ago, sure.
Like, but still sticking essentially with lithium ion, not solid state, or
that's going to be another breakthrough. But yeah, it's probably going to, it keeps getting pushed back.
Solid state's always about 5 years away, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. But what's now being the breakthroughs now are the membrane between the anode and cathode, and making them safer and more capable to take and discharge without any thermal load or thermal reaction, and therefore with less expansion and contraction of the cell. Because the problem with batteries is as they get hot, they expand. And if you've got a lot of cells, you know, 3 meters of cells all stacked together closely, yeah, and they get up to temperature, they can expand by 20, 30 mil, the whole thing. So you've got to allow for this. Yeah. And solid state expands even more. So the problem there is keeping the pressure on the batteries and controlling them. So solid state will work when they can solve the expansion contraction problem. Until then, the membranes in lithium ion and then the chemical composition as well as the cell format, you've got three massive variables before you even talk about the battery control module. So this is like the new combustion chamber. And instead of having 4, 6, 8, 10 or 12, you've got 1500 to 2000, which you can optimize, and you can have progressive torque and then a step. You can have linear torque, you can have a step with a flat line above it, and you can tune the cars and then the power delivery in ways that will feel comfortable but exhilarating, and we'll give them a Bentley feel, and they'll have parity in range with today's regular cars and much more power and technically much more performance and all the technology that I've talked about on top.
And Bentley in competition, you've often said to me in the past that competition remains at the heart of Bentley. Is there anything else you can tell us about that?
It still remains at the heart of Bentley.
Yeah.
If we could go electric endurance racing,
yeah,
not Formula E, I'm talking 8, 12 to 24 hours.
So not Extreme E or anything like that either?
No. LMP style racing,
yeah,
fully electric,
yeah,
we want to be in the pioneering phase. You know, we've looked at other things. GT3 is, we did it well, but it's really a customer-based sport. It's not a global motorsport program. And we're constantly looking. So no plans as yet,
yeah,
but motorsport is at the heart of the brand deep down. And watch this space, you never know.
Okay. So now we come to the end of it. So you have to tell us which one of the six cars you would take for your last blast, your very final drive in a car, and where you drive it. And the third question we usually ask is who you be with, but seeing as they're all racing cars, I'm guessing you're going to be on your own. Or maybe you wouldn't. Maybe you put a passenger seat in one of the two-seaters and have someone with you. I'll leave it to you.
Okay, well, I'm not saying it because of where I work. It's a tough one. It's like saying which is your favourite child. It would be the Speed 8, and it would be with Derek Bell.
And who's in which seat? Is he driving you, or are you driving him?
I'm driving him.
Excellent. And I'm kind of guessing I know where you're going to be.
Mulsanne Strait, Le Sarthe, in June, at a date very near you, soon.
Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed, Adrian Hallmark, for letting us hear about your last blast. Good fun.
Thanks, Andrew.